Hey everyone, back again. Today I'm starting a four-part series on Michel Foucault's The Archaeology of Knowledge, which I've actually covered before as more of a conversational type broad overview of the text with my buddy Alex. You can go and listen to that if you want. It's super useful for a more laid-back breakdown discussion of the themes of this book, why it's important and all that. But now I think it's important to also do more of a deep dive dissection of the book, because it's super important if you want to understand Foucault's thought, if you want to understand discourse analysis, and if you want to really understand the world, and you want to understand the many ways in which we come to delimit various disciplines to say that there's this thing called history, and then there's this thing called physics, and then there's this thing called mathematics, whatever. Foucault, quite simply here, is asking us to consider what mechanisms are in place to allow disciplines to emerge at all. And these disciplines then come to affect the way that humans, that people, come to understand history, the world, their neighbors, and themselves in so many ways. Now, that was a big preamble before saying, hi, I'm David. If you're new here, I explain philosophical concepts, texts, ideas, and ways to try and make them accessible to you. So if you're new here, you can like, share, subscribe, see videos. I think now I might be doing more like once every 2 weeks for a little bit because I'm so busy and I have to prioritize other things, but we'll see. We'll see what I'm able to do. So you can see videos that I release fairly frequently if you subscribe and follow and all those lovely things. You can comment, you can leave reviews, that would all be great. This is happening, or I'm recording this, against the backdrop of Israel's relentless slaughter of Palestinians and capture of Palestinian land, which has been going on for more than 100 years, and I've done a number of episodes on this, providing a history to Zionism and to Israel's occupation of Palestine and the Palestinian people, and systematically denying Palestinians rights, denying Palestinians sovereignty and autonomy to be able to live free of military occupation, free of the violence that Israel inflicts against Palestinians on a daily basis. And it's not just like some flare-up in Israel's political party where some would like to say, oh, since the 90s, when there have been this progressive, the early 2000s, this progressive, heightened, like extreme political extremism in Israel, some people like to say, oh, it's because of that, when no, this violence is embedded within the very fabric of the Zionist logic, and the violence will continue so long as that logic is allowed to continue. So if you're listening to this and you feel like contributing to me in any way, consider instead donating to one of the organizations I've listed below, because Palestinians need as much help as we can give them. And I know that there are many people who, and because I see you and you feel the need to comment, who might be bothered by that, in which case I very much welcome you to leave if this affects you. Or you can comment and tell the world how I've affected you with these words, and that'll boost me for the algorithm to reach more people. So I encourage you to do that too if you'd like. And please excuse my snarkiness. It's my one of the ways I cope with the massive amount of rage I feel on a daily basis now because of Israel's relentless violence. Okay, kind of a long intro. Let's jump into this just briefly. One more thing. Like I said, this is going to be four episodes. Pretty much every episode is going to cover each part of the book. Let's jump into Michel Foucault's The Archaeology of Knowledge. Now, before starting this, it's important that, you know, we just ask some questions. What is history? Like, what really is history? I don't mean to, like, editorialize or grandstand or anything like that, but, like, when you really sit down for a moment and question what history is, I hope that you'd kind of, you'd be dissatisfied with what you might have previously believed. So history is just the presentation, in the most reductive way, the presentation of the past. Now, there are so many history books, right? There are so many. It would be like almost impossible to read them all. It would be impossible to read them all. There's no possible way anyone could do that. And just think about your own life. Think about your own life and try to imagine how many books it would take for somebody to recount your entire life. It'll probably take thousands of books because you need to add interpretation, you need to add so many different nuances and understandings of who you are. You'd inevitably have to consider so many other factors that would require their own history books to figure out how they have affected you and shaped who you are. And so if you just think about that for a moment, think about the difficulty in recounting your own life, and this is just putting aside the impossibility of anyone to truly understand themselves. Like, we know this from the psychoanalysts, like the difficulty that's always presented to us when we try to convey our feelings, our understanding of ourselves, we run into some serious roadblocks. We are limited by language, which is a Nietzschean point from Nietzsche, and I'll explain in a minute. Don't get scared. I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But now imagine the entirety of human history. The entirety of, since we've been human, as far as like our physiological structure, maybe about 100,000 years, maybe a little more, I mean, something like that. And imagine the kind of hubris that is required for us to think that we somehow have a grasp of history. And I'm not saying we shouldn't study it. Of course we should. But it's kind of audacious for us to think that we can, and auspicious, favorable to success, in thinking that somehow we can properly represent history. When history as we know it is comprised of millions of people doing so many different things in so many different places, influenced by so many other different things, that it already seems like somewhat of an impossible task. And the problem gets really, it gets compounded when we consider the many millions and millions of people who are just erased in history. When you open up your textbooks, your history textbooks, chances are, if you're in North America, most of the people you're going to be reading about are white dudes. Just a fact. Were white dudes the only people in history? No. Were they the only people who did anything meaningful? No. However, this goes to show, just as like a kind of preamble, just as a brief illustration, how history isn't just this neutral thing that just looks at this quote-unquote neutral past and seeks to represent it. Instead, history might be a way to convey certain interests, to tell certain stories about the past, to shape public consciousness about the past in a way to affect the future. Because if you shape people's understandings of the past, you can shape their understanding of the future and how they will act in the future. Now, I said that this was a Nietzschean point. What I mean by that is I'm pulling from his In Truth and Lying in a Non-Moral Sense, or an extra-moral sense, depending on the translation, in which Nietzsche says that so long as we are using language, we are kind of deceiving ourselves. Because he says that really the only truth that we can find in language, that we arrive at through language, is truth that's been separated from us. It's an artificial truth. So he gives the example of mammals. And he says humans love to content themselves with identifying mammals out in the world. But Nietzsche says, like, what really is a mammal? I mean, that's a word we've given to describe certain creatures on Earth. And when we see a thing that complies with the definition and the specific characteristics and attributes we associate with that definition, when we identify a creature out in the world that fits those criteria, does that actually mean anything to the creature itself? Or is this just a way by which humans come to categorize the world? Humans come to capture the world. Humans come to organize the world. There's a really great quote. I think it's from, I love pronouncing French people's names in French, because the comments are always so funny. What, like, why are you pronouncing it like that? But Roland Barthes, as some would like me to say, Roland Barthes, has a kind of an image he provides us where he says, how many shades of green does a newborn or a child capable of seeing colors see in the grass as they crawl through the grass, they probably see what might be to us an infinite number of colors. Yet it's something that as adults we're taught, oh, it's just green. You know, the grass is just green. Or we can use another example of tree. Tree is an innocuous word, right? Tree doesn't offend anyone, I hope. But trees are an interesting phenomenon, because if I say, or if I tell you to imagine a tree, every single one of you listening, and myself, has conjured up a different image of a tree in our minds. So Nietzsche says that in this case, language performs the function of effacing differences and leaving only this kind of pure artificiality in their wake. What we have is the word tree, and it's meant to stand in for all of these variations of trees. It is meant to actually kind of round off all the differences and leave us just with this pure artificiality in its wake. So language is always bound up in this process of excluding things. That's the only way we're able to use language at all. No two people have the same image of a tree come into their mind, or a chair, or a computer, or whatever. We use language as a way to simplify the world, but it's not a neutral act. It is very much bound up with certain histories. It is very much bound up with certain interests in how these words are going to be taken up and what they are going to exclude in their being uttered, in their being said. But to go back now to the text, history is not even something that has enjoyed a static, kind of consistent history. History has undergone various changes in the way that it was conducted. For a long time, it sought to find these broad strokes in the past to reduce entire eras, entire periods to like these singular worldviews or ways of understanding the earth. But of course, that in no way, or society, in no way did these worldviews actually capture everybody's views of anything. It just captured, you know, those few people who could write things down that historians could then read later. Which is why there's like a fundamental bias found within history itself, where we are only capable, partly through colonialism, through the systematic erasure of indigenous ways of knowing and knowledges, we have covered over all of that in the West in favor of the written word. We've only maintained those histories that were written down, which is just one of many ways to actually collect history. There's also oral storytelling. There's storytelling through music and history keeping through music and other forms like that, through navigation, through geography, through so many things that gets erased in favor of the written word. And so all of those knowledges that have been kept in human history, and I'm using the term human history in like the broadest sense of like all people at all times, just everyone in the past, how much of that has been erased? How much of that has been forgotten by the academic gatekeepers in the realm of history in their appreciation of the written word? So history used to be really committed to just finding out these singular homogeneous worldviews. It looked for totalities, universal wholes to grasp entire periods and eras. Any deviation or disparate event or phenomenon or person that didn't comply would then be situated within, somehow it would be like really shoehorned in there, or it would be seen as some coincidental departure from that established norm or worldview or era or period or whatever. Now, writing this in the late 1960s, Foucault began to observe actually a transformation in the way that history was being conducted in the historical method that began to somewhat problematize the previous efforts within history to just reduce entire peoples to a singular worldview or to homogenize all people. And this is something that I hope eventually, one day, we're able to look back upon in the concept of like nations to undo the way that nationhood, the way that nationality has been used to homogenize people, to reduce them to an artificial idea about what they should be. Now, he describes this transformation, the transformation from history looking at broad temporalizations, from doing that to being a little bit more, looking at things a little bit more specifically and problematizing these periodizations, these and the way it treats deviations and so on. He calls this the transformation or the shift from total history to general history. Now, general history is not something to necessarily celebrate. If, you know, you're hearing this and you're like, oh, well, a more nuanced view, approach to history would probably be good. I mean, you want to include more perspectives, right? You want to include more ideas. You want more people involved. You don't want to reduce them to these broad temporalizations. But we really can't be fooled here. This new method did not do away with the older one. It simply reappropriated it to account for really exploding knowledges and new media that allowed more people to actually share their experiences, share their knowledges, share the histories that they knew on a localized individual level. Suddenly history was confronted, or the history as far as like the study of history, the history discipline was confronted with all of these different testimonies, and it had to find a way to make sense of them while also retaining its love of reducing the past to what is manageable, to what is organizationable. Organizationable. Nice, David. In short, it found itself needing to periodize all these new periods that were being opened up and discovered, to methodize the methods of history, to establish what he calls a series of series, to find a way to insert a homogeneous, totalizing framework to account for all of these new ideas, for all of these new perspectives that had historically just been totally ignored by historians. So in other words, it was looking for a new way to explain ruptures, to explain discontinuities, to explain disparate events and deviations without abandoning the historical method altogether. It couldn't get rid of that historical method. Now we saw other things were going on in different fields. Like if you went outside of history, there were other big changes going on in other fields. So elsewhere in disciplines like the history of philosophy or art or science or literature, where there is like a historical component, when you study philosophy, you're probably going to have to study the Greeks, St. Augustine, you know, Descartes, you're going to read all these people, you're going to engage in the history of philosophy. Science, maybe not so much. I mean, if someone does a science degree, you're probably not learning about like, I don't know, if you're doing biology, you're probably not learning about Pum or Bale or something. You know, the history within science is not really as important when you're learning it because a lot of that stuff is outdated and it's actual practice today. In any case, there are still people who study like the history of science or the history of literature, so on. But in these other fields, there was another transformation taking place. Not the same one found in history in this transformation from total history to general history. Instead, we saw the abandonment of the search for origins, homogeneous periods, unitary eras, in favor of a new type of rationality. So in his words, this approach seems to be seeking and discovering more and more discontinuities, whereas history itself appears to be abandoning the eruption of events in favor of stable structures. So what that means in non-Foucauldian English is that he's saying that history was still trying to locate, to use these overall homogeneous methods to homogenize history, to make sense of history, because otherwise, I mean, history is kind of doomed from the start because history is too big and expansive. It has to be selective. But in that selectivity, it is going to reveal just how committed it is to only certain histories, to only certain narratives, those that largely follow a European Western trajectory. Whereas these other fields, Foucault suggests, where you have the history of science, the history of philosophy, the history of literature, he said there was something else going on. And there seemed to be more of a welcoming of discontinuities, of ruptures, to be able to look at something that didn't quite fit within a canon, within an established field, and they didn't try to just make sense of it by being like, coincidence, that we shouldn't consider that. It fits within the canon because of this reason. You know, either of those methods, either of those approaches would uphold the canon as being like absolutely unchanging, determinative of everything else around it, as like a kind of gravitational black hole that shapes everything, everything around it, and fits everything within it. These other fields were instead, they would encounter something that didn't quite fit in with a previously established canon. And instead of saying, that belongs outside, or it belongs inside for XYZ reasons, these fields were saying, that's different. I don't know what that is. Let's explore it. And this isn't necessarily something that Foucault is celebrating either. I think that he's giving it a little bit more credit than the historical method. But in any case, it presents an interesting transformation, and it sets the stage for what will be his archaeological approach. So the archaeology of knowledge, where, spoiler alert, archaeology, at least one of its characteristics, is to search for discontinuities and to look at them as discontinuities, because that will call into question the very continuity that is implied or imposed upon history to establish a history at all, to establish periods, to establish temporality, to establish a canon. Now, to really illustrate the different approaches within history, Foucault considers the differences between the document in history and the monument. So traditional history, so history way of the past, you know, the history looking for these broad understandings of like entire eras and reducing them to these simple things, traditional history encountered monuments or relics or anything from that time, where historians like archaeologists are going and digging stuff up and they're like, oh, look at this cool thing we found, or there's a monument that stood in for something, or whatever. So traditional history would encounter monuments or relics and then sought to transform them into documents. And what he means by that, by transforming a thing found into something that can be read, understood, and made intelligible, what he is saying about this is that traditional history sought to transform things it found into being kind of evidence of an entire way a people thought, which is so, I mean, it's so reductive to find like an object and to be like, all the people thought this way, or this is somehow determinative of an entire period, that which now, I, you know, historians are probably not going to want to do. So just to be clear, traditional history would find monuments. It's looking at the past, it's finding things, it's digging things up quite literally sometimes, finding things, and then turning them into readable things that could then stand in for these periods. Within general history, though, with this transformation, he says that the reverse takes place. Instead of transforming monuments or relics or things that are found or things that are like the expression of a people, and turning them into the written word that can be properly intelligibilized, made intelligible, and then read and understood, he's saying that history began to do the opposite of transforming documents into monuments. Where something happened within historical analysis, where it began to approach monuments in a pretty brazen, hubristic way. I don't know, hubris is my word of the day, I guess. Where it was like, oh yeah, we know what this means. We totally know what this means. We are so sure we know what this means, this object, that we just know it's just going to stand in for all these people. So they treat it as like a document that can be immediately understood, as just something that just makes sense. And then transforming it then into a monument that now stands in for all of these people. However, by reversing the procedure, what we are seeing then is the adoption of a willingness to kind of go down various routes of various monuments that are taken as documents, but various monuments that are taken as documents because they are so easily intelligible, as a sign of the certainty that historians have really embraced during this, as a product of this transition. So here we see a confirmation, not of the monument as a relic of the past, really, or standing in for a people or anything like that, but what we are really seeing, and Foucault really wants us to be aware of, we are seeing the historical method presenting itself as neutral and objective. Perhaps we may even think of the museum here. You know, the museum performs a very interesting function in so many different ways. The museum, like, is such a violent institution, yet it is one that I will defend tooth and nail as being super important, while acknowledging that it needs serious changes. Where you go into a museum, and you walk in, and you see the little, your calc or your, whatever, the map, or giving you an idea about what's, like, what's where in the museum, and you got your Egypt over there, and you got your, you got your Chinese history over there, you have European history over there, you have the many different indigenous nations' histories over there, as though it is possible to construct a space that contains histories, as though histories can just be put side by side in these different rooms and just opened up to a kind of spectacle. And people come in and they can just receive these histories without ever really questioning the very structure, the very medium through which they are accessing these histories. As though history can just be this neutral thing that you pay $30 for, or maybe it's subsidized, maybe it's free. You walk in, you can go from room to room, you go from Egypt to Europe, to whatever. You go through all of these different places, all these different rooms, and you're just receiving history. And all of these monuments that you're encountering are totally intelligible to you. Not because any of us that walk into the museum actually understands any of these objects at all. Their historical significance, their significance at the time, to whom, and so on. But they are entirely intelligible because we are in a museum. And we know exactly what we are supposed to be doing in relation to these objects in a museum. They are just meant to be monuments for us. Monuments that stand in for the neutrality and objectivity of history itself. And it's not like this history is being reduced. I mean, most of the time, museums are curated with the utmost respect. And historians have so much respect for these artifacts, for these cultural icons, for these relics, and so on. I'm not saying they don't. We're getting at a deeper issue here related to the very logic of history itself. So within this space, within the museum, there may be a new acceptance of ruptures and discontinuities. There might be this new exhibit about this thing that's just found and yada, yada, yada. No one knows what it is. Let's explore it. Let's try to understand this thing in itself, not try to reduce it to like a canon because it was found in Egypt or something, and then reduce it to the entirety of Egyptology or something. Like, let's give it a little bit more space to breathe and to find its own way. Like, that could be happening in a museum, and that's great. But what is really happening in the acceptance of these new ruptures and discontinuities, what we are really seeing is the confirmation of history itself. What we are really seeing is the confirmation of the museum as a representation of history itself. So history no longer collapses all deviations to a single period or to a totality. It welcomes them and looks to fix boundaries, reveal relations, formulate laws, describe these relations, etc., between these newly discovered things, not by reducing them to something, but to find relations, to make them intelligible, to understand why a thing might exist, why it once existed, to situate it somewhere. Like, why do we do this at all? It's a very, very interesting process. Now, in the history of philosophy, remember, I described these other history fields or these other fields doing history. History of philosophy, of literature, etc. There is a more radical departure from the traditional history. For example, like, we can just think about Marxism, and Marxism has been a great enterprise just to reveal, among other things, that history is not just a neutral thing. In fact, the history that we've learned is a history that reflects upper class interests. and it historically has been, you are likely to read about people who are rich. That's just a simple fact. Most of your history books is going to be presenting people who had money and or power, which normally just go hand in hand. But this reveals how history is entirely ideological. Now, we may observe a similar transformation in other fields, albeit with less resistance than in history. So, for example, there's structuralism. And Foucault is called is often called a post-structuralist, a post-modernist, other things like that. Not a title he willingly embraced, even though this entire book is a criticism of structuralism. But even to say that implies that structuralism is this bounded, easily intelligible, homogenous thing, which Foucault is asking us to be a little bit wary of doing. But in any case, we find in structuralism a recognition of something different. It recognizes differences and studies them, but reduces them to structure, like semiotics. So semiotics, to be really brief, we know language doesn't mean anything. We know it's useful, but if I use the word, like I said, tree, everyone has a different idea about tree in their minds. So there is a split between the signifier, T-R-E-E, and the thing it's meant to represent, the signified. And so in this case, it might seem as though semiotics, which studies these kinds of relationships, is prepared to accept that there are many millions, billions, infinite number of ways to represent things in the world, because we can just come up with different sounds to represent them. But that's, you can't really have a field or a discipline if you're saying that. Because then what is there to study? You're just saying, oh, it could be anything. We could use any word to study something or to represent something. So semioticians and linguists, we could think of Chomsky here as well, sought to try to find out what was universal among all languages. Because there has to be some kind of underlying consistency that unites all languages. For Chomsky, these are the syntactic structures. That is, the structures that make it possible at all for us to have linguistic communication. What kinds of structure am I following in order for me to deliver words that you can then make sense of as the listener? I must be following some kind of a structure. Similarly, if I was speaking Cantonese, I'm following some structure that someone else must be also aware of to properly understand me. So language goes well beyond just the words you're using, but the very structure, the syntax that you are using to communicate those words, that language. So another example I like to give to illustrate structuralism is with fairy tales. So for a while, people thought that fairy tales were a peek into what is universal about us. Like universal cautionary tales like Little Red Riding Hood or tales about humility or whatever. But upon further examination, it's actually come to find that some of the most popular fairy tales were just kind of frozen in time, because you had the Grimm brothers, you had other guys in Europe, Charles, I don't know, whatever their names. There was a point in my life when I knew this, but it, in any case, we, when we are actually accessing fairy tales, are not accessing age-old knowledge. We are accessing actually highly edited stories that have been transformed from the oral tradition into the written form that kind of freezes the stories. And we see them readapted with like Disney and other readaptations that push the limits of those fairy tales. But in any case, there's a kind of violence that is done when a story, when an oral tale is written down, because it freezes that oral tale. And if you have someone writing it, like the Grimm brothers, who are coming from, a pretty rich European background, chances are their worldview is going to then have some kind of an impact on the way that that story is written down and then retold. So the structuralists might say, I'm not saying they're saying this, but they might say, oh, well, fairy tales are a peek into like universal human values. Whereas A post-structuralist might say, or are you just extrapolating from a single worldview and saying that it is universal? You know, how can we really claim that anything is universal given how difficult it is to recount even a single history? So history has resisted its own transformation to uphold, in Foucault's words, the sovereignty of consciousness in its teleological movement through and expression in time. So he continues, well, most of that was my words, but in his words, continuous history is the indispensable correlative of the subject, the guarantee that everything that has eluded him will be restored to him, the certainty that time will disperse nothing without restoring it in a reconstituted unity, the promise that one day the subject, in the form of historical consciousness, will once again be able to appropriate, to bring back under his sway, all those things that are kept at a distance by difference. So what does that mean? Well, just in the way that I was saying before, that in order for history to exist at all, it needs to greatly reduce the thing that it's studying. For history to exist, it has to severely limit history. Otherwise, it would be too chaotic to really be a discipline at all. There'd be too many narratives, too many ways of understanding, too many methods of history to even count. And Foucault says that the history that we've come to craft in the West, in the kind of record keeping that we do in our relationship to the past, is one that seeks not to actually understand the past as much as it seeks to impose ourselves onto the past, to locate ourselves in the past, to understand that we, as a sovereign subjects capable of looking at the past in such a neutral, objective way, the jeopardification of history is what I like to call it, where you can have TV shows that just like reduce history to number values, like $300 for ancient Greek history or something. I mean, what does that say about us in our reduction of history to that? Like, no attachment to it, no respect for it, just reducing it to something that we can just passively consume in like a museum, which again, I'm saying is good. I mean, these are fantastic institutions that do great work, but we're getting at something deeper here. Now, to go back to Nietzsche, because you really see Nietzsche's influence on Foucault here, in that same text, in Truth and Lying in a Non-Moral Sense, Nietzsche says that language is a way to anthropomorphize the world. It is a way to bring the world under humanity's dominion by giving things names. If you've read Robinson Crusoe, one of the first things he does when he gets on the island is name things. You gotta give it a name so that it can be understandable, so that it can be organizationable. It's my favorite word now. So that it can be containable. And so differences are effaced, or they are embraced so long as the same historical method is used, the same institutions, the same media are used to capture those differences. So history is then quite reactionary. Against Marx's revelation that history is only a total of a kind of capitalist interest being represented again and again, history looks to discover what unites all those it speaks of. And against Nietzsche's revelation that knowledge is a ruse to conceal power, history looks to uncover the legacy of rationality. So you have all of these criticisms, all of these real challenges to history, and history is just marching on against it. So Nietzsche says, Nietzsche's like, apparently this is a crash course on Nietzsche as well. One of Nietzsche's famous criticisms is his criticism of the will to knowledge, where for a long time, people believed that they were guided by the will to knowledge. They were just trying to make sense of the world. So Nietzsche goes after Socrates, goes after Plato, Socrates, goes after Kant, goes after many others, where he's like, these people believed that they were trying to understand the world and people. But what they were really doing was imposing their own view of the world onto the world. They weren't discovering anything because they were using language. What truth is there really to be found in language? Nietzsche asks us. And so these people weren't exercising the will to knowledge. They were exercising the will to power that is found in all of us. This desire to impose ourselves onto the earth. And, you know, the appeal to history can, it can be reactionary in the abstract ways I've been laying out. It can also be pretty reactionary and violent in quite concrete ways, like a strange turn to evolutionary psychology to justify patriarchy, to justify male aggression against women, to justify the existence of the heterosexual binary, for example. Like, all of these things can be explained away by pointing to history as being this one unitary stream of events that has led to this moment. As though, like, what a violence that is to commit to history. Like, what an amazing violence that is. Yet it actually earns the status of, like, a science, especially with evolutionary psych, that has a lot of scientific backing, quote-unquote scientific backing. But as we go on through this book, it might become clear just how difficult the task is that he's trying to do. He's trying to problematize all these disciplines by essentially offering us a discipline that he's calling archaeology, which he's like, we need to use their tools against them. We need to use their tools to identify the very problems found in each of their approaches. But we can only do that if we use their approaches, if we understand why there are these discontinuities within history. What does it mean to find a discontinuity or a rupture in history? What does that say about the regulative mechanisms that have established a zone of comfort, of intelligibility, against which we measure differences? Like, if history was truly history, everything would just be difference. Everything would just be its own radical different thing. Nothing could be really reducible to anything else. I mean, isn't that the case with language at all? I mean, if we were truly linguistic beings, we would have a different noun for every single object we encounter. But that's not what we do. We are also beings that love to organize things. And I'm not saying this is the case just ontologically in who we are as humans, but it has come through various efforts to impose an ordering on the world to comply with transforming ways in which knowledge is organized, attached to various institutions, the way that knowledge is attached to power in extracting truth from people's suffering as they are made to suffer and made to be test subjects and to be learned from in the prison. This is part of Foucault's other work, in the prison, in the mental asylum, in the doctor's office, and so on. And he concludes his introduction with a really great quote, because he's like, I'm going to make mistakes, and there are going to be things about this that I don't agree with in a few years. So he says, leave it to our bureaucrats and our police to see that our papers are in order. It's one of my favorite quotes ever. I use it all the time. Not here, but in my life. I like to leave it to our police and our bureaucrats to make sure that our papers are in order. Something that they are well fitted to do. And yeah, let's end it off here, closing out the introduction. Next time we'll pick up with part 2, which covers chapters 1-8. And then the next episode will cover part 3. Final episode will cover part 4. Yeah, if you like what I did, consider donating to one of the organizations below. You can follow me on other platforms if you'd like. And yeah, on that note, take care.